From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama says treaties obligating the U.S. to defend Japan include disputed islands in the East China Sea. A security guard opens fire on Americans at an Afghan hospital. An official says Ukrainian forces have taken back a building captured by pro-Russian separatists. Nigerians are frustrated over the kidnapping of schoolgirls. It's all ahead. I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. President Barack Obama has reassured Japan that the U.S. will abide by its commitment to help defend the country if China seizes a disputed group of islands. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the president in Tokyo.
President Obama came to Japan offering reassurances that the Japanese leadership has been wanting to hear. Tensions remain high over the islands in the East China Sea that Japan administers, but that China claims. At a briefing with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, the U.S. leader said the United States intends to uphold a decades-old mutual defense treaty in the case of the islands, known in Japan as the Senkaku and in China as the Diaoyu.
The treaty between the United States and Japan preceded my birth, so obviously this isn't a red line that I'm drawing. It is the standard interpretation over multiple administrations of the terms of the alliance, which is that territories under the administration of Japan are covered under the treaty. There's no shift in position. There's no red line that's been drawn. We're simply applying the treaty.
Mr. Obama comes at a time when confidence is shaky among many Japanese who see the United States' failure to make good on its threats to attack Syria and its reluctance to provide lethal aid to Ukraine as signs that the U.S. may not come to Japan's aid against China. The president is starting a week-long tour of Asia meant to show U.S. allies that the administration's promised pivot of its diplomatic efforts and military forces to Asia remains on track. He will also visit South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. In his conversations with Prime Minister Abe, Mr. Obama encouraged Japan to speed up negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a multinational pact that would create one of the world's largest free trade zones. The deal is held up by a dispute over Japanese agricultural tariffs. On Ukraine, the U.S. leader said he is getting ready to impose new sanctions on Russia for not following through on the commitments it made in Geneva last week to de-escalate the crisis.
We have been preparing for the prospect that we're going to have to engage in further sanctions. Those are teed up. It requires some technical work, and it also requires coordination with other countries.
The president heads to South Korea next. Tensions there have been heightened by indications that North Korea may be planning another nuclear test. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Tokyo.
An Afghan security guard today opened fire at an international hospital in Kabul, killing three American doctors. The assailant was shot and wounded by his colleagues and has been hospitalized under police custody. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad.
Afghan Interior Ministry officials said the deadly attack occurred when an Afghan security guard opened fire at Kabul's Khor International Hospital. Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui says the unfortunate incident is under investigation and the assailant's motives have yet to be determined.
The attacker was also shot by the other security guard and he's now under the serious watch of police, but he's now in the hospital. We do not yet know the motives and the reasons behind this attack.
In a brief statement on Twitter, the U.S. Embassy says that with great sadness, we can confirm that three Americans were killed in the attack on Khor Hospital. The shooting is said to have left a fourth U.S. citizen wounded. The hospital, run by U.S.-based Christian charity Khor, is considered one of the leading health facilities and training institutes in Afghanistan. Khor opened the medical facility about 9 years ago, and it specializes in children's and maternal health. Thursday's attack was the latest on foreigners in the war-torn country. Earlier this month, an Afghan policeman opened fire on two Associated Press journalists, killing the photographer and wounding the reporter in the country's east. That shooting came just days after Taliban insurgents stormed Kabul's Serena Hotel and killed at least 9 people, including a senior Afghan journalist with AFP. In March, a Swedish journalist was gunned down in the highly secured Wazir Akbar Khan residential part of the Afghan capital, while a Taliban assault on a restaurant in Kabul earlier this year killed 21 people, including 13 foreign civilians. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Fighting between Ukrainian security forces and pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine has left a number of militants dead. Ukraine's Interior Ministry says its forces, along with army units, killed five pro-Russian militants and destroyed three of their checkpoints in the city of Slovyansk. Speaking at a public forum in St. Petersburg, Russian President Vladimir Putin said if Ukraine's government has started using the army against what he termed the population inside the country, it would be, in his words, a very serious crime. Ukrainian officials said Thursday that police had driven pro-Russian separatists out of the city hall in the eastern city of Mariupol, and that an attack on separatists or by separatists on an army base in another town had been repelled. Israeli media reports that Israel's security cabinet has decided to suspend peace negotiations with the Palestinians in response to a plan by Palestinian rivals Fatah and Hamas to reconcile and form a unity government. The reports also say Israel will impose economic sanctions on the Palestinian Authority. The Security Cabinet held a six-hour meeting today to formulate a response to the agreement. An increase in the number of cases of Middle East respiratory syndrome in Saudi Arabia has alarmed health officials, but local authorities are offering few preventative measures to prevent the MERS virus. Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
Saudi Arabia announced two more MERS-related deaths and two new infections Thursday, one day after the World Health Organization renewed concerns about the dramatic jump in the number of victims in recent days. Health ministries from Saudi Arabia to Egypt have tried to downplay the threat of Middle East respiratory syndrome. The coronavirus, which proves fatal to about one-third of its victims, first appeared in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. Saudi officials report nearly 300 people have come down with the disease's pneumonia-like symptoms since then. More than 50 of those cases have been reported in the past week. Regional authorities say there is no cause for alarm or need to impose preventative measures such as travel restrictions. Dr. Amr Kandil, chief of Egypt's health ministry's preventative sector, says his agency has set up screening sites across the country to check suspected cases.
The total sample examined from human cases, it is about 8,500 cases, and all of these samples were negative to the MERS corona.
But Kandil said the probability for a MERS outbreak remains, given frequent travel by Egyptians to Saudi Arabia's religious sites and workers throughout the region. He also notes the virus is present in some Egyptian camels. The disease, believed to have crossed over to humans from camels, first appeared only to be passed through close contact with the animals. But recently, health workers treating people with MERS have themselves fallen ill. Cases tied to human contact have also spread to other parts of the Gulf and as far afield as Europe and Malaysia, raising concerns the virus may be either reaching a tipping point or mutating. Part of the lack of urgency on prevention may be tied to virus fatigue, scares tied to other viruses, including avian flu, which did not live up to the warnings they could mutate into more transmissible form. Much remains unknown about Middle East respiratory syndrome. Earlier this week, Saudi Health Minister Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al-Rabia conceded as much, even while arguing against the need for aggressive preventative measures.
Hopefully that we will reach to an idea why the surge is in April and May. Could it be that this season is the best for the virus? We don't know. We have no idea.
The next day, the minister was replaced. No reason was given, but with Saudi Arabia expecting millions of visitors in the coming months, during Ramadan in July and the Hajj in October, it's a possible sign the threat is being taken more seriously. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan is expressing surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. In an interview with VOA, the official warns the humanitarian crisis will become worse as the rainy season takes hold in a couple of weeks. Lisa Schlein reports.
Melker Mabek has just left his post as mission chief of the International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan, which he assumed in March 2012. At that time, he tells VOA, no one could have predicted the speed, geographical breadth, and ferocity of the crisis that erupted a little more than 4 months ago.
The country is not even 3 years old, and when I arrived 2 years ago, there was so much hope and joy and hopes for the future. It's been very, very sad to see these hopes destroyed in the last couple of months. You see the fear among people of a return to the old days of extended conflict and hardship.
Mabek says it is hard to predict the future, but the situation does not look optimistic. He says fighting between government and rebel forces will likely subside when the rainy season arrives next month, but the rains will pose other extremely difficult problems. He says more than 1 million people will remain displaced inside and outside the country, and reaching them with desperately needed aid will be a monumental challenge.
These people need food, they need shelter, they need clean water, and they need to be able to return to their homes at some point to start working the land again and to start producing food. The planting season has already been severely disrupted by this crisis. We're extremely concerned about the nutritional situation in South Sudan. Now, if this continues, it's likely to further deteriorate.
The United Nations reports more than 3.7 million people in South Sudan are going hungry. It warns 50,000 severely malnourished children could die by the end of the year if they do not get immediate treatment. Mabek says ICRC mobile surgical teams are deployed in areas affected by fighting and have treated more than 1,200 patients. He says the agency has provided basic needs for almost 200,000 displaced people.
We continue, of course, working on the issues of compliance with humanitarian law. This remains one of our main concerns, and we keep on a dialogue with both parties to the conflict and remind them of their obligations to abide by these very fundamental principles.
The Red Cross message that civilians must not be targeted does not appear to be getting through to the warring parties. The United Nations mission in South Sudan has accused rebels of killing more than 200 civilians last week after seizing the town of Bentiu. A rebel spokesman denied the charge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The shooting death of a prominent pro-government poet in Thailand is prompting concerns of more political violence in the country. Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
The daylight shooting of 45-year-old Kamol Dongphasuk outside a restaurant in the capital is the latest unsolved attack on a high-profile figure in Thailand at a time of political instability. Kamol, better known by his pen name, Mainong Korkonti, was a supporter of the Red Shirt Movement, which backs the government of interim Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who has been battling to stay in office. Kamol was killed in his car in the parking lot of a restaurant Wednesday afternoon. A leader of the United Front for Democracy, the core Red Shirt group, Dr. Weng Tojurakarn says it is obvious from the crime scene and the two wounds on the victim's chest that the activist artist was assassinated at close range.
I think that the bullet come from the pistol not very far from my name. So the assassin must be very close, maybe not more than 1 meter.
Kamol had spoken out against Thailand's harsh Less Majest law, under which those convicted can face up to 15 years in prison for defamation of the royal family. The red shirts are often labeled as being against the country's monarchy, something their leaders deny. A retired Army Major General, an anti-government figure who runs a private hospital in Bangkok, recently set up what he calls the Rubbish Collection Organization to flush out those allegedly insulting the monarchy. Dr. Weng says he sees no coincidence between the establishment of the new group and the latest killing. He calls for its founder, Dr. Rintong Nana, to denounce the lethal attack. Dr. Rintong declined a VOA request for an interview. UDD leader Weng says the red shirts, despite their anger at being targeted, will not retaliate.
We resolutely stand on the nonviolent method. So even we do know that mining has been killed by the political conflict, we still tell our colleague that please don't use the violent method because we can't overcome or solve the political conflict by the violent method.
The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch non-governmental organization is calling for Thai authorities to investigate the killing and bring whoever is responsible to justice, wherever that investigation leads. The group's statement also notes the recent formation of the pro-monarchy organization, which calls those accused of committing Les Majest offenses garbage and vows to exterminate them. Human Rights Watch says Kamol's death can only worsen the already tense political situation in Thailand. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Philippine officials say issues surrounding the botched rescue attempt of Hong Kong nationals held hostage at a Manila park nearly 4 years ago have been resolved. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
Philippine Cabinet Secretary Jose Rene Almendres says a series of meetings between the Philippine and Hong Kong governments over 7 months resulted in the Philippines meeting four demands of the victims and their surviving family members. On state-run television, Almendres, who led negotiations, said the government offered condolences, undisclosed reparations, reassured the victims it would hold accountable those responsible for the bungled rescue attempt, and take measures to ensure the safety of tourists. Almendres says Wednesday was the first time Philippine officials met face-to-face with a small number of the victims and their surviving families, and the government's sincerity was on the line.
At the end of the day, the family said, we will see if the sincerity is there. So I'm happy to report that that came across really well.
In August 2010, a disgruntled former policeman who was heavily armed hijacked a tour bus filled with Hong Kong nationals and demanded he be reinstated. The day-long hostage situation resulted in 8 deaths and 7 injuries after a police SWAT team tried to break into the bus and exchanged gunfire with the ex-officer. Since then, victims and their families had been calling for an official apology from President Benigno Aquino on behalf of the Philippines. The president refused, saying the entire country could not be held accountable for the actions of one man. The administration instead expressed condolences and offered compensation. The president and Hong Kong's chief executive had a lengthy discussion on the issue of the non-apology at the APEC summit in October, which prompted negotiations. In November, Hong Kong threatened sanctions against Philippine passport holders and non-renewal of its thousands of contract workers if the victims' 4 demands were not met. The first sanctions against the Philippines that revoked government workers' visa-free privileges to Hong Kong went into effect in February. Philippine officials met with Hong Kong government officials Wednesday. In a statement afterward, Hong Kong Chief Executive C.Y. Leung said the two governments and the victims reached consensus on the resolution of the 4 demands. He said the Philippine government expressed its most sorrowful regret and profound sympathy and extends its most sincere condolences. Leung says the sanctions as well as a years-long travel ban to the Philippines were lifted as of yesterday. On Thursday, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry said Beijing is pleased to see that this issue has been properly resolved in the end. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
More than a week after some 230 teenage girls were kidnapped from their school, frustration in Nigeria's northeast region is deepening. Female leaders blame the central government for failing to rescue the girls. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
More than a week after the girls were kidnapped, authorities say at least 190 are still missing. The dozens that are free escaped on their own, fleeing to safety through the bush. The girls that remain captive are believed to be deep within the Sambisa forest, where Boko Haram Islamist militants are known to hide out. Locals say they know roughly where the girls are, but they don't know how to stay alive long enough in the forest to rescue them. While no one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, it's widely believed that Boko Haram is holding the girls as spies, servants, or sex slaves. Dressed in black to show solidarity with grieving families, Aishatu Ngolde, a northern human rights activist, says the federal government's failure to locate the girls is tantamount to complicity in the crime.
Are you telling me that Borno State is so thick that no plane can see the ground? Why is there not been there in Borno over our children? They have been taken. We are all mothers. Even this judge's daughter that has been stolen today with the country to live, she would not.
Officials say security forces are using all means at their disposal to rescue the girls. Jan Saint-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says if the Nigerian military launched a direct assault in the forest to rescue the girls, they might kill more girls than they save.
The forests there are really dense. Geography and all the elements there are really hard to really prepare proper operation the way Nigerian army wants to conduct it. And so a full-scale attack that would make them look good and also show strength is simply not feasible. You would end up with many, many more casualties and civilian casualties than you would actually get Boko Haram fighters.
The Nigerian military has been silent in recent days after retracting an initial report that most of the girls had been freed. Saint-Pierre says a rescue would go a long way to improve the image of Nigerian security forces, but it would require negotiations accompanied by precision operations.
For the girls right now, it's finding the proper back channels that would allow for negotiations and that would allow the girls to be freed. They would then save face.
Nigeria has been mired in the Boko Haram insurgency for almost 5 years now, and three northeastern states have been under emergency rule for almost a year. Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths in attacks on churches, mosques, schools, marketplaces, the government, and most recently, a bus station bombing in the capital that killed 75 people. And things are getting worse, with rights groups saying 1,500 people were killed in the first 3 months of this year alone. Some weeks, attacks are reported every day. Some attacks never get reported. Despite the chaos, Gambo Maman Gesau, another leading northern human rights activist, says the girls will not be forgotten.
Let them release the pure children. Poor children, let them release them. If they are not going to release them, we women in the Nigeria, we are going to gather ourselves and march.
Besides air support and resources, female activists in Maiduguri called on Boko Haram militants to negotiate with the government, promising the militants motherly support towards rehabilitating them when the need arises. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Australian authorities say debris that washed ashore in the western part of the country is not related to a missing Malaysian jetliner. The unidentified material was found near the coastal town of Augusta. A search for the plane is taking place, although heavy rain, strong winds, and large sea swells hampered searches today. Well, that's it for this edition of International Edition here on The Voice of America. Thank you for joining us. By the way, you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Again today, sitting in for Susan Yockey, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day.